I wanted to say something about love, because it's clearly key today, clearly key in any day, and yet it's often talked about in rather sentimental or bland ways, just sort of reached out for as if it's a panacea that automatically cures all things, when clearly it doesn't. And I think that some insights from developmental psychology can help to give it nuance and also deepen its applicability, actually, because what developmental psychology suggests is that love actually grows through periods of loss or suffering or struggle. And it's quite clear that loss, suffering, and struggle characterize our now and will do so into the future, whether it be because of COVID, because of climate change, because of environmental degradation. We're going to need to cope with these difficulties. And to be able to see how love actually relates to them and grows with them, that can be, I hope, a real benefit. So it helps us to reflect personally how we relate to our times, but also perhaps collectively, perhaps socially and politically even, because love operates in groups as well as individual psyches. And so having some sense of how the group is doing in relation to love can be helpful as well. It's part of the inner story of now, personally and politically. And so understanding love aright with a bit more nuance can, I think, help resource us for now, particularly in times of struggle. So here's some of the developmental psychology. It starts with when we're born, perhaps before we're born, that deeply beds inside us, in our bodies, the sense of unity, of oneness. We're conceived in unity, evolve in the womb, in oneness with the mother. And the idea is that that continues for some period, at least, after we're born. It's a survival necessity because we're not able to communicate our needs otherwise, and so must scream and shout or show gorgeousness to indicate where we've received what we've needed. So it's necessary for a while. And any parent that's had a child will understand this. Freud talked about his or her majesty, the baby, the way that the whole of life is orientated around the child to deliver its needs. You know, a special room is made for it. Work stops, the day and the night merge in order to tend to the child. And it's desirable for a period, but of course it's unsustainable. The child themselves must move on to a different kind of love. And when that doesn't happen and remains operative, maybe even dominant in adult life, it gives birth to what is known as narcissism, the desire that the whole world continues to love you. You see it in the adult who lives by fiat, as if their words should and could just bring things about automatically. You see it in the exercise of power, almost to force people to love you, or the exercise of charm, the desire for the crowd that adulates you. And then it becomes very unstable, dangerous, and stirs up all sorts of splits, not just in the individual, but in the body politic, as we've come to know so well. But if in infancy, and who knows, perhaps even in adult life, that one love, the love that thinks the whole world is a unity, can be moved on from, then it gives birth to a second kind of love. And this is the love of two. Now, this love of two was actually there all along, of course. The parent was there, given there was good enough parenting, that itself wasn't interrupted. And the point about the parent loving the child is that they hold and contain the child, enabling them to move from this unified, demanding love to a more relational kind of love. You know, holding a child is a very interactive process. You've got to contain its rage and crying, be able to tolerate that yourself to help the child process the loss of this sense that the whole world's there for it. It's this way in which love and loss are deeply intertwined. But when that loss is contained, held and processed, love grows and the child too becomes aware of the parent as a separate entity, a separate person, and relationship can therefore grow. It also means that the child can not be trapped in a kind of fight or flight relationship with the other. Now that happens through childhood to some degree, but again, the parent's task is to help the individual move beyond just fight or flight. And I think that that is one of the difficulties which we've got now in our politics, as well as the narcissistic side, that we don't quite trust the other. I'm not so much thinking actually of other human beings, but the institutions that are supposed to look after us. This is called attachment, and in attachment theory, the idea is that you develop a good enough attachment, which means that you don't have to have the other, be it parent, institution, there on tap all the time. You can trust it to not be there. You can trust moving away from the parent, knowing that when you need it, it'll be there to return to. And I think that that loss of trust is part of what's affecting our public life now. You might say we've got insecure attachments to our institutions, particularly, say, the NHS. It has a very good track record here in the UK, the Public Health Service, but the sense that it might buckle under our needs suggests that even the NHS is going the way of other institutions, like, say, government, like, say, the church, that we feel have got their own concerns really at heart. And so we've lost trust with them. That is at risk too, I think, with the NHS. And that's part of the present struggle around COVID and what to do and what not to do, how to balance lockdowns and so on. However, in early life, if this move from fight or flight in the dyadic two-person relationship can be itself wrestled with, suffered to some degree, the loss of the sense that this one parent is there for us all the time, come what may. If that too can be undergone, then a third dimension, a third kind of love starts to emerge. And it's right to call it three or three-dimensional, because that's about not just me and the other parent, but is about me, the other, and other things as well. Maybe another parent, maybe a sibling, maybe others in the playground, maybe things like the sense that there's a workplace out there that the parent every so often has to go to. When the child can accept that it's not just me and one other, but me and many others, life grows again, because it's not just about a relationship of two, but now a relationship of many, three-dimensionality. And that starts to feel like life as it really might be, because then there's always, as it were, others to get to know, to relate to befriend. Life really starts to fly at this point. You know, in infancy, it's around the age of perhaps 4 or 5, when life starts to be enjoyed in a much bigger sense, you notice, as a parent. Collectively and politically, it's when there's a sense of identity, knowing who you are in your, say, particular part of the world, but being able to relate to different parts of the world, not because there's a dream that somehow we're all the same, but because of the difference. It's a unity found in diversity, not a unity found in the desire to make everyone one. That's this three-dimensional quality, which, you know, there's quite a tussle over now in the modern world as well. Now, the great thing about this third kind of love is that itself can grow, itself can lead to a new realization. And this is the sense that there's an inner side to it, as well as the outer side. The inward form of three-dimensional love is the sense that it's not just me and my struggle, me and my joys, but there's an awareness of me and my struggle, me and my joys, the capacity to take a step back and to reflect, to have a mind about what's going on that's not wholly caught up in what's going on. This is the kind of love which is preserved in wisdom traditions, in religious traditions. It's given many names, perhaps the name of compassion, perhaps the name God. But what's so great about this is that it enables a resilience in life, because that third position of awareness standing back, pure consciousness, as it's sometimes called, is increasingly able to be aligned with. So that enables a kind of engaged detachment with the world around. It's been part of life, but also being able to step back from life at the same time. And so not be just stuck in whatever's happening there and then, but holding on to a vision of what life might be as well. And when that is not only known in the individual, but when it's known in the shared or collective sense, the sense that life has a purpose, that there's a direction, there are ends, there's a kind of unfolding, that too increases the resilience of a society or times. They can undergo difficult moments, and you sense that that too is quite hard to hold on to in the present moment, part of the struggle of now. But love always says that with struggle comes a wider possibility. It's not about returning to the fantasy of all things being well, as perhaps they were at the beginning. It's about growing through difficulty, through loss, in order that life can be known more and more expansively. So even now, when we feel that loss of the third dimension, the vision, the mindedness, there's the possibility of moving to a fourth kind of love. This is four-dimensional love. And this is the awareness that love was there all along. Before we were born, after we die, love will still be there, a flow of life, a pulse of life, a divine life. The many names that it's called is what we were born into, what we're invited to share with, if we can unalign from the sense that we somehow own or possess life and become aligned with life in this broader four-dimensional space. William Blake had a wonderful phrase for it when he said, "He who binds to himself the joy, does the winged life destroy?" That's these earlier one, two-dimensional kinds of love that try to bind yourself to the joy. But winged life won't allow that. But, continued Blake, "He who kisses the joy as it flies lives in eternity's sunrise." So kissing the joy, life, this flow, as it passes you by, means that actually you always live in the life that otherwise would feel like it's passing you by, and hence living in eternity's sunrise. Because there's been the perception, the realization, that life and love always were there, grounding your life and love. But it can only be fully appreciated with the struggle, with the sense of loss of the earlier kinds of love, the command and control oneness of love, the fight and flight two-ness of love. Even in a way, the three-dimensional love, which has a sense of awareness and mindedness that can become a bit cut off from wider life, but in the fullest vision actually is the bridge to becoming more and more aware of wider life. So I think that we need these three and four dimensional kinds of love now. And perhaps the way to think about this is to notice yourself when you're in these different positions. You know, sometimes one-dimensional love is actually needed in moments, say, of self-defense. But if it's the only kind of love you know, it's going to lead to these destructive, narcissistic kinds of love. Sometimes two-dimensional love is needed, and when we're falling in love and when we're building a romantic relationship with someone, we want that two-ness for a while, but there's also the sense that it becomes a bit narrow after a while as well, and so it's got to open up into three-dimensional love. Notice when you're in the three-dimensional love, where you can enjoy meeting others, feel free in the world, and also have that sense of mindedness inside. But notice too when you have that sense that life is love itself. It has a pulse. It has a flying quality that can be kissed, even as we find ourselves in eternity's sunrise. And by getting to know when you're in these different positions, it becomes more and more possible not to forget the four-dimensional love, and so to trust life, to trust love through the suffering, through the failure, and who knows, perhaps help foster that in wider life, shared life, our politics, society and culture, which desperately needs them now.